Tonight on Banfield, Law and Order California style. A DA who won his post as a reformer may well lose it tonight for the very same reason. Progressives and criminals all over the country are watching closely. Plus, for two long days, police in Montana were searching, but it wasn't a manhunt, it was a child hunt. And tonight it is mission accomplished. I'll speak with the sheriff who found this three-year-old boy named Ryker Webb safe and sound. And I'll ask him, how on earth did this little boy survive in the wilderness? Also ahead, mind-boggling fortunes, foreign intrigue, backlash and betrayal, even murder. Pro golf sure ain't what it used to be, and Saudi Arabia is the reason. Tonight, one of golf's legends follows the money straight into the sand. And later, another grim milestone on a road that only seems to go in one direction. Tonight, about a third of the country is paying $5 a gallon for gas. You can complain all you want, just not to your friends in Hong Kong or Norway or pretty much anywhere else in the world, because they, my friends, have it way, way worse than we do. And then everybody likes to get liked. But what good is cyber affirmation if your actual life is in shambles? Tonight, one of the very first influencers, JC Dupree, on the fine art of liking ourselves instead. Those stories are all ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. This could be the beginning of a brand new America. Primary voters in seven states went to the polls today to choose their party's candidates for local, state, and federal offices. Now, often these races are something of a formality. You know, it's like the appetizer to the election's main course. But tonight, it's different. Tonight, it's not just about Republican versus Democrat or right versus left. No, tonight, we're actually going to get a glimpse into how the country could swing to the left or to the right in November's general election. For the Republicans, the question is, what does the GOP stand for and who is in charge? And you might find the answer here. Last year, 35 House Republicans made a very big decision, a very risky decision too. They chose to vote for a bipartisan commission that's mission was to investigate the January 6th attack at the Capitol. Now, at the time, President Trump went ballistic. He was really mad about that. And he vowed severe retribution on all of them, on all 35 of them. Tonight, we're going to see probably if Republican voters feel the same way as Donald Trump does, or if they'll side with Donald Trump. Because five of those 35 House Republicans who made that choice, they are up for election today. Now, they may not be names that you know, but how they do in today's races could show us how far to the right the Republican Party is leaning these days, or not. Those key five candidates are David Valadao in California, Dusty Johnson in South Dakota, Chris Smith in New Jersey, Marionette Miller-Meeks in Iowa, Michael Guest in Mississippi, and we are just starting to get some of the results in as well, at least in two of those states. Chris Smith in New Jersey has a big lead. In Mississippi, it's a different story. Michael Guest is trailing the Trump candidate. That candidate's name is Michael Cassidy. So we'll continue to watch the numbers, and as they come in throughout the night, we'll let you know how these five are doing and other races that are key. But when it comes to the Democrats, you need to look no further than the state of California. In the biggest, bluest state in the nation, rising crime and homelessness have been burning issues in many key races, and surprisingly, the Democrats themselves have switched to tough on crime messaging and calls to remove homeless encampments there. But will their new conservative approach to crime in California spell the end of liberal prosecutors and the defund the police movement? I want to bring in News Nation's West Coast correspondent, Nancy Liu. She's been reporting on this all day. Nancy, in California, the voters have been pushing for criminal justice reform just in the last couple years, but now it looks like San Francisco's DA is actually in peril of losing his job because of that very mission. So tell me how things are going there.
You're right, Ashley. We're hearing a lot of frustration in this town. The polls are still open. They're about to close here in San Francisco. But the fate of progressive district attorney Chesa Boudin is up in the air. He is expected at this restaurant gathering later tonight. But at this point, it's still not clear whether his supporters will be celebrating or consoling him. In a final push for support and survival as San Francisco's district attorney, Chesa Boudin has a blitz of campaign stops.
The recall is lying to people. It's suggesting that getting me out of office is going to be a magic bullet solution to problems that are deep-rooted, decades in the making. It's simply not true, and voters in San Francisco are smart enough to see through the lies.
Boudin stresses that the pandemic hit just 2 months after he took office 2 years ago, but he followed through on his progressive campaign promises, policies aimed to end mass incarcerations, cash bail, and the trying of juveniles as adults, and gang members are spared lengthy prison sentences.
Decarceration, closing the jails. This is not what America wants.
Richie Greenberg helped to initiate the recall effort. He says Boudin's progressive policies have clearly failed.
This sends a green light to criminals, either those that are living here in the city or that live in the suburbs around, to come on in and do what they want.
This world-famous city by the bay, now famous for homelessness and crime, and viral videos like this mob of looters who targeted upscale stores last fall. Scores of residents have been attacked, many of them Asian Americans who had helped to vote Boudin in. Now many are among those who want him out. Statistics show that since Boudin took office, hate crimes are up, along with murders, robberies, and burglaries, while rape and assaults are down. Boudin stands by his progressive policies.
I know that San Francisco has what it takes to be a leader, to stand by our principles, and I know that every single reform we've implemented is one that will make our community safer in the long run.
Now, a recall requires a majority yes vote of over 50%, and recent polls have indicated that Boudin will be recalled. If so, Mayor London Breed will get to appoint a temporary replacement, Ashley.
So I'm just looking at the clock, and it's about 52 minutes and 10 seconds till the polls close in California. So I'm not going to ask you to prognosticate, and we don't have real numbers to share with our viewers. But I am going to ask you this, because I know you are a resident of that state, and you spend a lot of time in San Francisco. So just personally, how do you feel living there, and have things changed for you? Have you really noticed something as a resident?
Yeah, I actually live in Southern California now, but I grew up in Northern California, spent a ton of time in San Francisco, and I can tell you this city is different. There's high, I mean, we're always on heightened alert. I've had security guards with me, and as you know, news crews have been targeted in this town. They've been held up at gunpoint. A lot of equipment has been stolen. So there is a different feel here. Just driving around, we watch people openly doing drugs on the streets. Yes, there are homeless people all over the place. So it is a problem here. And Ashley, I have a brother in Silicon Valley, and he refuses to come up to see me. Maybe it's for another reason, but no, he does cite the crime. He refuses to come into the city.
Well, I know it's not for the reason that you made a joke about. Everybody loves you, Nancy, but that is very distressing. And honestly, I know that you've been, you know, poking around and asking people, you know, when you get the opportunity. Republican or Democrat alike, no one likes crime. No one likes open drug use on the streets. Are you getting a sense that it's very hard to find somebody who still really likes these soft on crime policies?
Well, there are people around here that Boudin is saying, hey, they need time for these policies to have an effect. And he says, you know, that COVID pandemic hit 2 months after he came to office, and that upended his office. But people point to all the prosecutors who have left his office because he is soft on crime. So he claims that, you know, this is a big Republican campaign to get him out of there. And he claims that there are people who believe in his policies and that they can work.
Well, we'll see in 50 minutes. Nancy Liu, thank you so much. Be careful out there. Thanks for doing this. Say hi to your brother. Okay. I want to bring in someone now who knows a lot about the swinging pendulum of American politics. Michael Reagan is a political commentator, a Republican strategist, and he's president of the Reagan Legacy Foundation, which advances the causes of his father, the former president of the United States, Ronald Reagan. Michael Reagan, it's so good to see you again. It's been a while since I've had a chance to talk with you. Thanks for doing this tonight. I'm just going to ask you right off the bat. You just heard Nancy Liu. She says that Chesa Boudin and those like him say it's just a matter of time, that they need the time in order to allow these sort of softer approaches to crime to really play out and move the needle. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so we need more crime. We need more looting. I mean, when they start looting Beverly Hills and that area of Los Angeles, what's going on in San Francisco is unconscionable. I have friends of mine who won't come to the state of California. It doesn't matter where you go, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, it's all the same with the crime and the smash and grabs and what is going on. People are fearful. You can't go down Rodeo Drive and wear a watch. If it's a nice watch, you're going to be beat up. Your watch is going to be stolen. If you're having a nice lunch down in Beverly Hills, you could be ransacked by those people coming down. It is not safe in California. I have a four-year-old and a six-year-old granddaughter. Live in Sherman Oaks, nice area of town. But every night, there is crime. My four-year-old and six-year-old cannot even walk around the block in Sherman Oaks because of the needles that are all over the block as you walk around. My son has to protect his four-year-old and six-year-old from walking around the block. It's not safe here, and you can just look at these DAs, whether it's San Francisco or it's Los Angeles. But the problem is this state is run by liberal progressive Democrats, and it has been for a long time. We tried to get Gaston out once. That didn't work. Now he's up again. There's 68,000 votes short of getting him recalled, have it be on the ballot. I worry about California, and I worry that if the recall doesn't work in San Francisco, they're going to feel they have a green light to keep on going all across country.
So what do you get a sense? I mean, listen, you live in California, you've been there a long time, mm-hmm. you're watching what's been playing out until the, you know, to the primaries and these choices being made tonight. Do you think that this is all of a sudden something's different? Do you feel like the pendulum has swung, or are you still feeling like it's a state of flux for Republicans and those who, and the Democrats alike, who feel like it's time to get tougher, back to going tougher on crime?
First, Jeff, no, there's really no Republican Party in the state of California. The Republican National Committee hasn't been here in years. They come here, collect money, and they leave. They get out of Dodge. So there's no real leadership here. You only have about 32% of the public are conservatives or Republicans, if you will. You have the one man running for mayor, Caruso, who was a Republican, became a Democrat. He would never get elected as a Republican. He had to become a Democrat to get the Republicans to vote, and for Democrats to vote for him. So it's really up to the Democrats if they want to change. The Republicans have wanted to change for a long time. But nothing's going to change unless Democrats show up in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and vote. But you look at 20% of the people are going to come out and vote today in the primaries. So 20% of the people in Los Angeles are going to nominate 100% of those who are going to represent them going into the future. That's unconscionable.
Let me ask you this, because a lot of Democrats in California have been changing their political messaging, and it sounds very conservative. I mean, they're saying, let's get tough on crime. I just want to ask if those who don't ascribe to that philosophy, the Democrats who are holding fast to the progressive policies, do you think that their criticism of those who criticize these policies, these crime policies, is that, look, we're in a different era because COVID and the economy has just, you know, it's just got people desperate and broke, and that's why crime's up, not because of the crime policies. Is there anything to that?
No, crime is up because nobody gets prosecuted for those crimes. I mean, look at this kid with the car, stolen car, runs over a mother and a child, and he's kicked free before the mother and child are out of the hospital. I mean, this is the way it is in California. It's an olly, olly, oxen, free, free, free. Has nothing to do with COVID. That's just a blame game. It has to do with the fact that nobody's being prosecuted. That's why you have people in DA's office leaving the DA's office. That's why the DA is being sued by people in his office, if you will. So it has nothing to do with COVID. That, again, is just one of those, let's blame COVID, let's blame Russia, let's blame everybody else, when, in fact, this state is run 100% by Democrats, two-thirds majority in the Assembly, two-thirds majority in the state Senate. So, and then you have a governor who's a Democrat, you have a mayor who's a Democrat. The hope is that you, is it interesting? We're looking for a Democrat to take over the mayor's race because he used to be a Republican. That's where we are in this state.
So the last time I heard someone use the expression "Ollie Ollie Oxenfree" was when your dad was president, and I was in grade school. So I'm going to take you back there because you started it, and I want to ask you in all earnestness, if Ronald Reagan would fit into the current Republican Party today.
Oh, listen, I think he would have some trouble. Because in 1986, Simpson-Mazzoli, they would hold that against him, if you will. But so would John Kennedy. John Kennedy had trouble getting in the Democrat Party today. I mean, both parties have changed in many, many ways. But, you know, both of them, you know, looking for leadership, if you will, going into the future. But John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan today would have a tough time in their respective parties. I would like to think Ronald Reagan would still win the nomination. I'd like to think John Kennedy would still be in a position of power. But he would be too conservative, and my father might, in fact, be too liberal for the Democrat or for the Republican Party. The parties have both changed over all these years, and you can look at social media and all the things around it that have actually changed the dynamic of politics today.
Well, we're different animals, right? We literally know way more than we should with all the information in our hands at any given moment. But that does make me ask this question. I started this segment with you talking about you knowing the pendulum swinging in politics. Do you foresee the pendulum swinging back to a day a little bit more when your dad was running the show in the Republican Party and John Kennedy was running the show in the Democratic Party? Do you see things going back to those days, or is that horse out of the barn and we are going to have to figure this one out and it's getting ugly out there?
And you know something, you're going to have to figure it out yourself. You know, we happen to live in a great time, but whether it be the 60s with John Kennedy and Jackie and all that, or Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, it's a different time. What happened? People are angry. You know, I don't care if you agreed or disagree with John Kennedy. He loved America. I don't care if you agreed or disagree with my father. He loved America. We have nobody out there anymore that's talking about loving America. We don't teach our children to love America. I mean, you have D-Day that just happened, and you have a lot of kids don't even know what D-Day is all about. They have no idea. I went to Normandy a couple of years ago to raise the American flag at the American Cemetery. 25-year-old kid here in L.A., who I was playing golf with, said, well, why would there be a cemetery at Normandy, France? Or I was in Berlin.
Wow.
I was in Berlin a few years later and said, what do you know about the Berlin Wall? Young high school student said, well, the Americans put it up to keep the communists out of their sector. We don't educate. I learned about America, say, at the right front seat of a station wagon as a small boy, 8, 9, 10 years old. My dad would pick me up on a Saturday morning and ride me out to the ranch. He would sing me about the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard. He would talk to me about America, the greatness of America. Nobody's talking about the greatness of America. We're pointing fingers and blaming America while the rest of the world is waiting for us to lead. We're sitting back saying, what the hell happened?
Yeah, I really hate the fact that both parties, these candidates, scream at each other and then scream that the other guy hates America. That's just not true. I don't think there's any candidate out there, Republican or Democrat, who hates America. And I'm going to one-up you on that station wagon. I'm from Canada, and I learned a lot about America growing up. And sometimes it was from the 8-track tape of The Best of America, the actual band, The Best of America. So Ventura Highway is in my head, even as I speak with you. Hey, will you come back a lot and talk to me again, Michael? It was really nice to see you.
I love to. It's a great time for me and do it. I'll probably catch hell from people. Say, oh, what do you mean, Ronald Reagan? Well, you know, it's a different time. And the Republican Party is going to have to find their leader, and the Democrat Party is going to have to find their leader, and they're going to have to find a way to get together. Ronald Reagan got together with Tip O'Neill. You have Bill Clinton. Somebody asked me, who do you think the best president was since Ronald Reagan? I said, Bill Clinton. And they looked at me like, are you nuts? I said, no. Bill Clinton balanced the budget, gave us welfare reform. Who did he work with? Newt Gingrich. Those were times when people worked together. We don't work together any longer.
Well, I like that you're fair-minded. It's why you're on News Nation. Thanks, Michael Reagan.
You got it.
All right, I want to turn now to this really unbelievable story that we found. It's a story of survival, effectively, but police are still trying to piece a lot of it together. A 3-year-old boy found alive and in good health after being missing for 2 full days in the wilds of Montana. The little boy's name is Riker Webb. He was last seen on Friday playing with his dad in their backyard. Dad just scooted inside for a hot minute, but then when he came back, Riker was nowhere to be found. Dad started searching the property, the neighboring properties. The police started a formal search 2 hours later. Code red is issued. More than 50 people actively searching for Riker. Brought in the dog teams, the drones. The sun set on day one. There's no sign of that three-year-old. Same story on day two, no Riker. But then they finally spotted him on Sunday. And Riker was 2.4 miles away. He was reportedly hungry and thirsty and cold, understandably. But again, alive and in good health. And I am right now joined by the Lincoln County Sheriff, Darren Short, who led the search for Riker. Oh, Sheriff, first of all, thank you for being here. And thank you for doing the job and finding that little boy. First of all, how's he doing?
He's doing fine now. He's doing fine. Thank you,
Glad
Ashley.
Glad to hear that. So, Sheriff, how did he get 2.4 miles away?
So there's an extensive trail system behind his house, and he was used to playing in that trail system. So he just walked away from his house and went to the familiar place that he usually played in, is the trail system up toward the mountain.
But if he was just hanging out on the open trails, how did it take 2 days? I mean, I would think you could fan a bunch of people out on those trails. His little legs won't take him too far and find him so quickly.
So one of the issues was we got the initial report about 4:53 in the afternoon, and he had been missing for possibly 2 hours or more at that time. And by the time our search and rescue volunteers and our deputies started searching for him, he was quite a distance away. We started from the house, the point last seen, and started fanning out from there. And by the time we got to where he might have been, he had quite a lead on us. So I sincerely—
Sorry, Sheriff, was little Riker able to articulate, I mean, at 3 years old, how much can he say, but has he been able to articulate to you guys what he did to stay alive in heavy, heavy rain, cold nights, and out in the wilderness for 2 days?
So yes, I spoke with Riker a little bit. I asked him if he'd been on a walk, and he said yes. And I said, was it a long walk? And his voice changed a little bit, and he said yes. And I said, were you alone? Yes. And I said, were you very tired? He said, very tired. And I truly believe that he walked that entire distance Friday afternoon before the thunderstorms hit. And from the time the thunderstorms hit, we had steady rain throughout the weekend. And that's what kept our air assets to a minimum, other than the drones that we were able to get in. And the Montana Air National Guard, who came to assist us on Saturday. But I truly feel that once the rain started to hit and the thunderstorm started to hit, Riker was smart enough, even as a three-year-old, to take cover in that shed. And I truly believe that he took cover in that shed from Friday evening until he was found on Sunday.
So you just said a shed. I didn't know that part of the story, that he was discovered in a shed?
Yes. He was discovered in a shed behind an old log cabin that's unoccupied probably 90% of the year. What I found out
was
today—
Was there anything in there, like any supplies, any food, any warmth for this little guy?
No food, no water. One of the miraculous things was there was a grass catcher bag from a push lawnmower. And he used that almost like a sleeping bag.
Wow. And what about, I saw him in the ambulance. It looked like he was wearing, I'm not sure if it was jammies, but he would have been really soaking wet and very cold. Was there anything he could find to give him some warmth?
So I think that when the thunderstorm started to roll in, Riker was close to the cabin and the shed. We found handprints on the front windows of the cabin, like he had looked in the windows to see if anybody was there. And I truly believe that he found the shed for shelter as the thunderstorm was rolling in. So he really wasn't wet, at least 2 days later when we found him. And I think that he beat the thunderstorm to that shed. I think he took shelter there through the entire time that it rained through the weekend.
Sheriff, so often I've covered these stories, and when it comes to little ones like Riker, who's only three, many times searchers will say they remain in hiding, even when those who are coming to find them and rescue them are right upon them. They can hear the rescuers, and they're so afraid they stay in hiding. Is that what happened with Riker?
I truly think so. I truly think so. The couple that found him had been around their cabin for some time, and they heard a slight whimper. They didn't hear him call out. He didn't ask for help. They heard a slight whimper, and then investigated the shed a little more, and found little Riker tucked into that lawn catcher bag, that grass catcher bag.
So the picture that we're seeing on the screen has him, you know, beforehand, and then in the ambulance, I think, and he looks like he's in pretty good spirits, having just gone through this horrendous ordeal. Do you know if when they found him, he was crying, or was he full of joy when he was discovered? Like, what was his mood when they found him?
So, what I understand, and I arrived, I was the first one there after the rescuers found him, and He was basically, I felt in a state of shock. He was still a little bit scared. He didn't know who we were. He didn't know who the people who found him were. And I truly think he was frightened. And he had been out there for 2 days all by himself, hearing the rain, hearing the wind, hearing everything that was going on around him, not knowing if he was going to get home. And I truly think he was basically in a state of shock and a little bit afraid.
I'll bet his mom and dad are hugging him so close tonight. Sheriff, thank you for finding him. Thank your men and women who went through all that trouble to bring that little guy home to his parents. And thanks for being on tonight, too.
Thank you very much. There was a tremendous group of volunteers, and I truly want to thank them.
Well, we'll send that out as well. And thanks again for this this wonderful resolution to a terrifying story. You know, all moms out there like me, you can't go 20 seconds without, you know, knowing where your little guy is. So to know that it was 2 days. Thanks again, and hopefully we'll see you under better circumstances. At least this is a good resolution, though.
This is a good resolution. Thank you, Ashley.
Sheriff Darren Short of Lincoln County joining us tonight. Coming up, talk about being teed off. Yes, pun intended. Golf fans are up in arms over a decision by Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, and Greg Norman to thumb their noses at the PGA and instead join a new Saudi Arabian golf league. It's all about the money, huh? Well, is it? And if it is, how much money are we talking, and who's next? And maybe more importantly, what did Tiger say when the Saudis came calling? That's next. There is a reason why American parents spend hundreds of millions of dollars on golf clubs and golf lessons and golf equipment and golf camps for their kids. A, it's because the kids love the game, and B, because if even there's a remote chance that kid could grow up to be the next international golf sensation, the fame and the success that comes with it can mean hundreds of millions of dollars. Like around $800 million if you're Tiger Woods, $700 million if you're Arnold Palmer, $400 million if you're Jack Nicklaus, or Phil Mickelson, and $300 million if you're Greg Norman. That's the reported net worth of those guys. So it is a little bit strange with that much money they have, you know, to hear that several of the golfers on that list are giving the Heisman to the PGA and instead signing on with a brand new Saudi Arabian golf league. It is called the LIV, Live Series. And being a startup, it could have decided to groom and develop the next generation of golf superstars, or it could just throw down insane amounts of money to snap up the superstars of today. And guess which option the Saudis went with? Yep, the cash. Its biggest get to date came yesterday. Phil Mickelson, winner of six majors, pocketed a reported $200 million to team up with this Saudi league. And this is a league he was really, really bad-mouthing just 3 months ago. Dustin Johnson, who's won two majors and now is ranked 15th in the world, signed on today for a reported $150 million. And if you're stunned by all of that, hang on to your five iron. the Saudis reportedly offered Tiger Woods almost $1 billion to ditch the PGA for the LIV. And Tiger reportedly said, no thanks. So here's Phil Mickelson's biographer, Alan Shipnuck, on Rush Hour today with his theory behind Tiger's decision.
Did the Saudis really offer Tiger Woods $1 billion?
You know, they probably could, but, you know, nobody's confirmed that in his camp. I do know Tiger twice turned down huge appearance fees to play in the Saudi International Tournament, which used to be a European Tour event, now Asian Tour. A lot of these guys played there earlier this year. Clearly, they would have loved to have had him on board. Given his current physical and health state, 8 tournaments it sort of suits him. You know, maybe he'd only want to play 4 of them. But it makes some sense that they would offer him a ton of money. Right. And it would probably be a lot more than these guys. I don't know if it got that high. I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that.
Great interview of Alan Shipnuck by my colleague, Nicole Burley. And after the break, is the Saudi way of doing things the fair way? Huh. What are the hazards of throwing in with a foreign power that is shadowy at best and bloodthirsty at worst? 2 masters of the sport weighing in when we come back. Okay, set your DVRs. Something big is going to happen on Thursday. And even if you don't like golf, this is a doozy. Because it's the first ever tournament for the Saudi Arabian-backed LIV Golf Series. And I know I hadn't heard of it either. I might not have even cared so much about it until I heard the kind of money that they're throwing around to make this thing a success. And then also until I heard about the kind of money they're throwing at famous PGA golfers to make them turn their backs on the PGA and join the Saudi League instead. When the tournament kicks off outside of London on Thursday, 48 professional golfers are going to walk onto the links. And basically declare just by being there that they are okay with being paid by a regime that ordered the murder of this man, a famous journalist I used to work with back in 2002, Jamal Khashoggi. Players like Phil Mickelson and Dustin Johnson, who's ranked 15th in the world and is married to Wayne Gretzky's daughter, Louis Hoosijsen and Sergio Garcia, they're all playing too. So is this just a job? Is this just the game of golf? Or is this a sellout to the highest bidder who also happens to be murderous? Joining us now to break it down is Chantal McCabe, who's a reporter and host on ESPN and SiriusXM and hosts the show PGA Tour Live. And Brad Means has been an anchor and reporter for the last 24 years with WJBF in Augusta, Georgia, which means that he's covered a lot of Masters championships. Welcome to both of you. Chantal, I'm going to begin with you if I can. I'm from Winnipeg. And, you know, a couple decades ago, we lost the Winnipeg Jets because bigger, glossier money bags came in and we couldn't afford them. So I am very sensitive to having people stolen away by rich folk. And it feels like the PGA could be gutted if the Saudis keep doing this. Is there a risk that this just could keep going? The money will go up, the Saudis have endless supply, and the golfers are all going to leave the PGA?
Ashley, good to be with one of the great journalists we still have left. And sorry about your Winnipeg Jets, but money does talk, and that's not just exclusive to golf. That's all over sports, and then far beyond that. And when it comes to this storyline, as Brad can attest to, those of us in our golf bubble, we have been tracking this for 2 years, and a lot of these headlines are just telling an itty-bitty piece of the story. I needed a flowchart the size of a 3-car garage to get all of the story out, but we'll try to wrap it up in as much as we can. When it comes to the money on the PGA Tour specifically, it wasn't until this year that there was guaranteed money if you're starting. So unlike NBA, MLB, and NFL, you are not guaranteed money. So you show up for an event and you have young kids, as you mentioned in the last segment, who are excited to see Ricky Fowler dressed head to toe in their orange. And they want to see the stars of the game. But if those players don't make the cut, that means they had paid for their flights, their travel, their hotel, their food, everything that comes with being on tour for a week at a time. So there's some nuances to this that is part of the story of why players are motivated for this money. And the most glaring thing, you threw out some facts and figures, $200 million is what is reported, and there's no confirmed numbers as it stands right now, but $200 million is what we've been told players have been told that they will get, and that is confirmed as something that players really want to have. Now, if you look at the biggest purse on the PGA Tour, you lose a lot more than you win. So the biggest purse, one person got $3.6 million for a win this season at the Players' Championship. And so $200 million versus $3.6 million, we're talking about a significant difference. And the PGA Tour has started to put some programs in place to incentivize players and say, hey, we want to keep you here, not just for legacy, but we know that money is important. And this sport is a lot different than what you see in other parts of the game.
Well, money sure talks, because I want to read something from Phil Mickelson, Brad. And this was just from January, I guess just a couple months ago. This is what Phil said about the Saudi League. They're scary mother effers to get involved with. We know they killed Khashoggi and have a horrible record on human rights. They execute people over there for being gay. Knowing all of this, why would I even consider it? Because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reshape how the PGA Tour operates. And then this was Mickelson's statement just yesterday. I'm thrilled to begin with LIV Golf, and I appreciate everyone involved. I fully realize and respect some may disagree with this decision and have strong opinions, and I empathize with that. Brad, what am I to make of that, and what are the other golfers gonna say?
Well, I think from a public relations standpoint, Ashley, and certainly from the perspective of Team Mickelson, they're hoping that that second statement you read pushes that first statement further back in the public's mind, if you will. But remember this, after those comments were released, leaked, put out back in November, Mickelson said, look, those were told to a reporter off the record. They were taken out of context. And then a couple of months after that, February, I believe it was, he said he was deeply sorry for what he said. Those words do not reflect his true feelings. And he issued an apology. He also said that before we ever have change in this world, we have disruption, his words. And my words, we're in the middle of that disruption right now. And Phil has indicated he is ready to take the criticism that comes with being the face of this new league. So he apologized, but if the slings and arrows keep coming, he's ready.
Well, I love the part of the story where Tiger Woods reportedly says no to a billion. Maybe that's the reputation, fixer-upper that he might have needed after all these years. I have to leave it there, but let's keep talking about this because I have a feeling there's going to be more shoes to drop. Chantel McCabe and Brad Means, thank you both. Coming up next, can a lifetime of likes add up to a life that you love? When we come back, one of the very first social media influencers shares some secrets that she never, ever dared put online. With millions of likes, why didn't she like herself? That's next. If you're among the tens of millions being influenced by all those social media influencers, or if you're related to someone who is, then you're going to want to meet JC Dupree. She was an influencer before we even had a name for that. She attracted millions of online followers with a picture-perfect life that anybody would want to emulate, but nobody could because it was fake, or at least far from the whole truth. JC shares that story in a brand new memoir called Liking Myself Back, and she shares it with me tonight as well. JC, thank you so much for being on with me tonight. First of all, at Farm Girl to Damsel in Dior, I had no idea that you weren't happy. Tell me a little bit about this, like, realization and why you're spilling the beans.
Well, thank you so much for having me, first and foremost. I'm just thrilled to be here. You know what? I've been doing this for 10 years. I can't even believe I'm saying that out loud right now. And just after doing it for so long, there's just so much more behind the scenes that was going on, behind the filter that you see on Instagram, that I felt as though I needed to share with the world. I just really wanted to tell a part of my story in hopes that it would really help reach other people and really help make a difference.
You know, I was reading in the Times, I think, last weekend that, you know, depression, anxiety, suicide is all up among adolescents. Many point to social media. Do you think, like, your book and this whole, like, coming clean about the filters is going to help change this? Like, we need a sea change, right, to right the wrongs of what social media is doing.
I mean, gosh, that's the whole point, right? That would mean the world to me if it could just touch one person that's kind of going through something hard. And I'm the daughter of an alcoholic. I struggle with PTSD, ADHD. I had some postpartum depression to throw into the mix. So there's a lot in this book, a lot of vulnerable moments. And if one of those stories can just help touch one person, then yes, that's definitely the goal here. Social media, you know, it just, we share all of those picture perfect moments, and it's not always easy to share the more vulnerable, honest moments in our lives. And that's really the whole point of this book. So yes, that would be a huge win if it's able to affect
people. And you have a daughter, right? So what's your plan for managing her social media? What's going to go on in your house?
Isn't that the million-dollar question? We're actually trying to figure that out now, just with my account only. Like, how much do I post of her and how much do I not post? I want to protect her. Right now, my biggest goal for kind of protecting my daughter on social media is, you know, we share a little bit about her and what we're going through with her, because we're proud of her, we love her, we want to share that part of our lives. But I also don't want people, like, having a premeditated, like, opinion of who she is as a person. So I don't want her walking to a room and being people thinking that they already know her. So I'm trying to kind of toe the line and draw that boundary. As far as where she wants to take her life on social media, I feel like Instagram, I mean, who even knows if it will still be around when she's, you know, 13, 14, 15, or TikTok, like, who knows what we'll be getting into at that point. So I figure we'll just cross that bridge when we get there.
Your book is called Liking Myself Back. I think there's a lot of great lessons in here. JC Dupree, thank you so much for being on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, here is a question for you. What do all these states have in common? They're listed on your screen. Go ahead, take a look, see if your state's on the list. And here's a hint. It has to do with gas prices. After the break, we're going to show you how bad this list of states has it and why most of the rest of the world is not going to shed one tear for any American driver. That's next. Welcome back. These 13 states all have one thing in common. The average price for gas in these states now tops $5 a gallon, according to Gas Buddy. The national average isn't a whole lot better at $4.95 a gallon. And I know what you're thinking. That is terrible. Just the worst. Absolutely inexcusable. But believe it or not, this actually could be a lot worse. Much of the world pays a lot higher gas price than we do, especially the following five countries who have the highest gas prices on Earth. Zimbabwe at $8.90 a gallon, Norway at $9.15 a gallon, Monaco at $9.23 a gallon, Central African Republic at $9.34 a gallon, and check out Hong Kong, $10.87 a gallon. It turns out, folks, that the gas is not always greener on the other side. And listen, it's funny to say that, but since it is bound to be an election issue and a lot of people are going to campaign on it, you should know that this is not just exclusively an American problem, even when candidates are going to try to make it so. You know better. The world is struggling on this one. Hey, thank you so much for staying with me through this. I want you to stick around a little bit longer because Leland Vitter is coming up next with Special Report, and I'll see you tomorrow night.